Blog Talk Radio.
Ujima Living, the solution to death culture. We'll be talking about that in just a few minutes. Please stay with us. Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination, freedom, and sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversation about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you would rather listen on your computer, go to www.uslistingus.com, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. You'll be on the Blog Talk Radio website at that time. My name is Sister Q, and joining me for this tonight's Brother Auntie, who, like me, is a member of ULU. Peace, Brother Ankti. How you doing tonight?
Peace, Sister Q. I'm well. Thank you. Good to hear your voice.
good to hear yours, and we're looking forward to tonight's conversation. So the subject for tonight is Ujamaa Living, the Solution to Death Culture. So, Brother Anti, what do you mean by the term Ujamaa Living?
Thank you, Sister Q. I think that's a critical question, and it shapes the conversation that we're about to have, raising the need to understand the economic system that underpins or undergirds the reality all of us find ourselves living in. And if we want to exist in a society that produces and promotes life, then we have to have an economic system that promotes life rather than an economic system that promotes death. Many listening to this program are familiar with Ujamaa as the fourth day of Kwanzaa. Mm-hmm. Ujamaa has been defined as to build and maintain our own stores and businesses and profit together from them. Ulu is expanding and deepening this definition by incorporating Mwalimu Julius Nyerere's definition of Ujamaa, which points out that the root meaning of this Swahili term is familyhood. Hence, mm-hmm. Ulu is building an economic system that is family-centered, or an understanding and practice of familyhood that creates an economy. This deeper definition of Ujamaa allows us to build an economic system for our people that is genuinely cooperative, in that we collectively own our own stores and businesses. It's important for our listeners and all of those who are participating with us in Ulu to understand that we're not only operating stores and businesses, we are putting together a network of economic enterprises that allow us to create an economy to support our lifestyle. In the Ulu model, workers are owners of the Ulu businesses.
Uh-huh.
Also, customers of the businesses are also owners. So both the people who work in our businesses and the people who shop in our businesses are owners of these businesses. Therefore, the community collectively owns and operates the businesses that serve our community. Hence, businesses in our community are no longer parasitic and extractive, but now are part of a circular flow of financial energy enlivening all aspects of our community. And if you think about the neighborhoods where we live, when we go out on a normal day, we may have to go to the grocery store. We may have to go to the cleaners. We may have to go to Home Depot. We may swing by the beauty supply store. We may go by the drugstore. Our goal is that each of the businesses that we as people need would also be Ulu businesses, so that all of the commerce that we do in any given day would be done in an Ulu owned and operated business entity. That is the goal, because that then allows us to live with an economic framework based on the values of Ma'at, truth, justice, righteousness, order, balance, harmony, reciprocity, and also the values of Kwanzaa, unity, self-determination, collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. When those are the values that guide how we treat each other, how we do business with each other, it changes the whole tempo. It changes the whole feel of the places where we live. It puts the focus of our energy back on taking care of each other, taking care of the environment. Really, it gets us back to a place where we are living in harmony with the environment and with each other. Because we don't have that kind of economy surrounding us now, we find ourselves in these businesses that practice cutthroat competition. They're hyper-individualistic. They don't care about the communities in which they operate. And what I mean by that, if you just think about how many of us have lived in communities, we once had thriving malls that were anchored by, say, a Macy's or some other, a Sears or some other major chain. And when those chains decided that they weren't making enough money in these places where we live, they shut those businesses down. And when they shut those main anchors down, the entire mall went down. Uh-huh. So was it that these businesses were not making money? No, they were making money. They just weren't making as much money as the owners of them wanted to get out of those businesses, and so they closed them. And so we see that that's what I mean by businesses that are extractive and parasitic. They stay there as long as they can, as long as they can make maximum profit, their doors are open. But when they start making less money year after year than the year before, then all of a sudden they start laying off some of the services, and the next thing you know, 2 years, 5 years down the road, they shut it down. You wanted to ask something, Sister Q?
What I wanted to say is that the example that you gave of the anchor store leaving a community mall is a good cause. When the anchor store leaves, then all of the other stores in there start dying because they don't have enough traffic to to maintain themselves, and that expands out into the community, because now, you know, these people that used to work here don't have jobs, and it's a domino effect. Because the people in the anchor store, it's not, as you said, it wasn't that they weren't making any money. They just wanted to make more money. And so they took their stuff and went, and that left everybody else to die on the vine, basically. So I'm glad you brought up that example.
Yeah, and that's an excellent metaphor, talking about dying on the vine, because when the anchors pull out, it's just a matter of time before the other businesses have to shut down as well, because the anchors were the major attraction in terms of foot traffic at the point that you would make.
Right. Yeah. So
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You continue with what you were saying.
So the first point that we want to raise for our thinking tonight is the idea of Ujamaa living. Ujamaa is more than just operating businesses together, right? Ujamaa really speaks to, and this is what we have to get deep down in our spirits. Ujamaa is a way of looking at the world through the eyes of spirit, through the eyes of our ancestors, through the eyes of a way of being together. You know, we talk about Ubuntu, I am because we are, and because we are, therefore I am.
Right.
And so this idea of a family, and when we work together as a family, the goal is not to profit off of each other. The goal is to meet each other's needs. I make shoes. You make suits and dresses. So I come to you to get suits and dresses. You come to me to get shoes. And we work out an equitable price. And so now I got clothes and shoes. You have clothes and shoes. And this is a sustainable way of doing commerce together. As opposed to I'm in it for as much money as I can squeeze out of you. And then when I can't squeeze any more money out of you, I'm gone. So what we're trying to build is a community, and in every community you have to have an economic system or an economy that operates underneath the community. When the economic system is driven by mutual respect and mutual love and concern for one another, then that community is going to thrive and prosper, and it's going to have longevity from generation to generation to generation to generation, because it's driven by this concern for each other's well-being. It's not driven by how much money can I get out of you. And so that's what we mean by Ujamaa living, creating a network of businesses that enable us to have our needs met in a way that is supportive of everybody that lives in this space. I think many of us have had the experience of going into businesses where the people who owned the business didn't like us. And so they served us, but you could feel the tension in the air. You know, they kind of watching you and making sure cameras everywhere, people walking up and down the aisle behind you, and this gruff treatment. And that is not the kind of community and business climate that we want for ourselves and for our people. And in order to build the kind of climate that we want, that's just the point. We're going to have to build it because the people who have come into our neighborhoods to offer services don't particularly care for us. The only reason that they're there, whether they are Korean or Asian or Vietnamese or Hispanic or any other ethnic group that has set up shop in our neighborhoods, the only reason that they're there is because they know they can make money off of us. And that's what they do. They're there to make money off of us. And so the money that we pay for the goods and services they provide, that money doesn't stay in the community. When they shut those doors down at sundown or 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock or whatever time they close their businesses, that money goes back to the place where they live and circulates in their communities. And so their communities get the benefit of our wealth, and we never see that multiplier effect in our neighborhood. So that's the challenge before us. As we grow in our understanding of how an economy works and how these businesses, when they're interlocked and interrelated with each other, how the synergy they create then provides the abundance that makes for healthy community. So this is not something that we can treat as optional, because as the economy slows down and these businesses shut down and move out, what we are left with are these abandoned stores that become places for violence and mayhem and high unemployment, and that's what we see. And so people wind up, you know, moving out of those communities into other communities that seem to be doing better economically. But if we watch the cycle over a 10-year period, if we don't take a proactive role in building prosperous and healthy and vibrant communities, we won't have them. And so that's why the work that we in Us Lifting Us are doing is vital to our survival, so that our children can have a future without us having to move every 10 years to chase some other community that seems to be more economically viable than the communities that we live in.
Right. And, you know, there's another example of death culture. Another aspect of it is that someone else comes into our community and does their commerce and takes our money out of our community so that we're not in a position to build in our community, or growth can't happen in our community because the money's gone, you know, and their community is being built up for whatever they're doing with the money that we had. So as saying in Uru, we have money. It's just, it passes through if it gets in, you know, because a lot of us, before we get our paycheck, we already owe most of our money to various people, you know.
Right. I think we have a caller that has a question.
Yeah.
But we're going to come back to your point.
Okay, I was just getting ready to say we have a caller, so let me open the line for our caller here. Good evening, caller, with the last four digits, 3440. Please state your name, where you're calling from, and ask your question or make your comment. Thank you.
Good evening, brothers and sisters, Sister Q and Brother Auntie, it's a pleasure listening and hearing your voice. Very interesting topic. But I got probably two questions. One, could you have spoken earlier, Brother Auntie, about these fundamental values, virtues that we have, you know, Ma'at and the Nguza Saba. How can we instill that in the community? And the reason I'm asking that is, you know, I was looking at a program and a commentator was asking a guest who was from Chicago, and Chicago has probably one of the highest murder capitals in the world, and it's mostly us killing each other. Obviously, those values are not instilled there, or at least are not instilled among those who are engaged in those criminal activities. So when someone looks at that, and when you say that, and what do you see as a pathway to begin to instill those values? And my second question is dealing with this. As these foreign entities come into our community and gouge us and take money out, what is it that we're not seeing, and what should we be seeing? Maybe that might be a little bit related to the first. If you could answer those two questions, I'd really appreciate it. And thanks again for the program.
Thank you.
Greetings, Brother Shabaka. It's good to hear you. You asked two very profound questions. If you think about some of us on the program tonight, we're older than when Dr. Milana Karenga introduced Kwanzaa. And so prior to the introduction of Kwanzaa, and we talked about the Nguza Saba, you know, the seven values, that was the first time many of us really had seen them written down and articulated in a clear way. It's just probably in the last three or four decades that we're hearing conversations where Ma'at is mentioned and those values. And the thing I think, Brother Shabaka, you probably can relate to is that when we go through the Kwanzaa celebrations, the only time that we see those values even trying to be practiced is for the 7 days of the Kwanzaa period. But the further we get into January and February and March, we seem to forget all about this idea of unity and self-determination and collective work and responsibility. So you're absolutely right. How do we instill these values? The short answer to the question is that is the rope, that is the work that an economy does in a community. And what I mean by that is that every time the register goes ka-ching, what's going on is a set of values is being reinforced. We have to really dig into that. When we're on our jobs, when we're doing these transactions in these other businesses, capitalism thrives on materialism, hyper-individualism, domination of others, competition, the hypersexualization of women. Those are the underlying values. And so every time we are caught up in this commercial system, those are the values that are being reinforced over and over and over. So it's no wonder that in the places where we live and we don't control the economics, then those values of black folks ain't, you know, the S word and it's all about me, myself, and I, and later for you, and I don't care what happens to you. All of that destructive behavior is like on steroids. Well, that's because the economy reinforces that consciousness, that mindset. And so one of the ways that we break it, first of all, we have to know what values it is that we're trying to instill. And at least we have a roadmap. We know what we want. The second step then is creating businesses that allow us to practice those values on a daily basis, one-to-one interaction and group interaction in the places where we do business. And so it is absolutely essential that we build these businesses that are based on a different set of values. And then to your second point about how do we counter these foreign elements that are in our community, we have been, I think, now check me if you have a different take on it, we've been led to think that the business initiative or it's another group of folk that's supposed to operate the businesses. We're not supposed to operate all the businesses in our community. It's okay for foreign elements to come in and set up shop and do business in the spaces where we live, and we don't have anything to say about it. And unfortunately, if we look at the way black elected leaders operate, even when they control the city council and the mayor's office or the county commissioner's office, too often they see opportunities for places where businesses could be operating. They're sitting around waiting for some entity to come to them and say, hey, we want to put up a gas station on this corner. We want to put up a vape shop in this spot. We want to put up a liquor store here. So they're always opening the door for other communities to come in and do business in our area, and then they pat themselves on the back and say, look how much leadership we're providing. We've got these thriving businesses in our neighborhood. They never came to us at a town hall meeting and say, hey, we're going to have to take control of the economics in these spaces, and we're going to have to set our own businesses up in these places. And here's the critical point, Brother Shabaka. We don't want to set up a privately owned business that's only going to exploit the people, whether it's black, white, yellow, or whatever. We want to set up a cooperative business that our people own and that we can profit from together. Now, tell me the politicians that have been saying that. And we need that kind of leadership. Someone in the community has to say, hey, A, we've got to take control of the economics in the community. And secondly, we have to put in place a particular kind of economics. We've got to move away from these privately owned businesses that only benefit the owners, and we've got to put in place businesses that are owned by the entire community, the businesses that are family-centered, and that are collectively owned. That is the missing ingredient, we think, in Ulu, that why we have not been able to transform in a more dramatic way what our communities look like. I hope that that answers to some degree the question that you were raising, Brother Shabaka, and thank you for asking it, because I think it's a crucial question.
Okay, so Brother Anki, you know, what you were saying just now in answering Brother Shabaka's question about our so-called leaders and how, you know, so many times they don't bring to us what is available to us as far as setting up businesses and things in the community, or if money's available for particular ventures, they don't bring it to the community. They might mention it to some of their friends to help their friends grow, you know, make some money.
Set up a business. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or they
yeah, you're right. You're right.
They just, when the, you know, we look up one day and there's a store, a new store on
mm-hmm.
the corner. We have no
mm-hmm.
idea how that happens.
Right.
So I think one of
mm-hmm.
our areas of concern, too, is the people that we classify as leaders. Because, you know, like, it seems to me today are going in a different direction than we want to go entirely. So they're not. And how do you think we would put them in check, you know, get them to see what,
your point
we're,
is well taken.
What we're wanting to do?
Your point is
do.
Well taken. That's exactly what we've seen happen. And that has to do, going back to, I think, in part, Brother Shabaka's question, it's something that Carter G. Woodson said, you know, when we are given the same educational training that the dominant class comes up with, we think like the dominant
uh-huh.
class. So
uh-huh.
we don't even think that there's a different way of doing business that would benefit the entire community and not just, you know, a small family or a handful of their friends and their cronies. But
uh-huh.
I want to get to the second point that Brother Shabaka's question alluded to, and that is this idea of group ownership and collective ownership and why this is so important. Now, this is the crux of the economic challenge that is in front of our people, not only black folks, but the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
Group ownership of our stores and businesses, and this is the point that I want everyone to hear, shifts the control of the means of production from private entities to public entities, frees or liberates our productive forces, allowing us as a people to once again become makers of our own history and determiners of our own destiny. What am I saying? We live in a system where private families, private individuals, private groups, they own all of the businesses, all of the corporations, all of the stores, all of the economic engines are privately owned. And we've been conditioned to think that, oh, this is normal. This is the way economics has to work. Nah, stop. There are other methods of doing this. Now, we hear a lot of banter going back and forth, capitalism or socialism or communism, and everyone is forced to line up in one of those two camps. The genius of Nwalimu Julius Nyerere, when he came forward with Ujamaa as an economic model, he was raising for us to look at utilizing African communalism. In 2021, that looks like a cooperative business. And what is a cooperative? It's a business enterprise that is collectively owned by the people who use it. Plain and simple. So if if there's a dry cleaner in the neighborhood, it can be owned cooperatively. In Cleveland, as a matter of fact, there's the Evergreen Laundry, the Laundry Corporation. They own and operate as a community an entire dry cleaning and laundry business that serves the hospitals and institutions of higher education in the Cleveland community. The people who do the work in the factory, in the business, they are the owners of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what Ujamaa Living gets us to. That's the place it gets us to. Whatever business is in our community, it should be owned by the community, not by private individuals. And why is that important? All of the wealth in the current model, it's the workers who generate the wealth. They generate the surplus value or the profits. They go in there 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 or 8 to 7, whatever, 8-hour day, 9-hour day, 10-hour day, whatever it is, whether we're looking at the people at the cash registers in the Kroger, it is the people doing the work who generate the surplus value or the profit. The problem is the people who call themselves the owners, they only pay those workers a portion of the wealth that they're creating.
For
so
sure.
Let's just say they created $10,000 worth of value. They only get paid $500. The $9,500 of surplus goes into the pocket of the owners.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason that that is so critically important is because it's the owners that make the decision about how much money the workers will walk away with, how much money will be in their pay envelope. So when we collectively own the businesses, we don't have to, you know, the workers don't have to go out on strike to get a higher minimum wage. I mean, the minimum wage hasn't been raised from $7.50 an hour for the last 30 or 40 years. That is absurd. But that's
uh-huh.
because the owners of the businesses, they make more money by putting the workers in the situation where they're paid the least amount that they can pay them. So
exactly.
If we own and control the business, when Ulu, for example, operated Cafe Ulu, our goal was to start with the workers who were in there making a livable wage, either $10 or $15 an hour, because we know
uh-huh.
that people have to live.
Exactly.
So our goal wasn't to maximize profit so we could walk away millionaires. Our goal was to put as much money in the hands of the people who worked there and in the community that supported the business, and to take a portion of that to put back into charity businesses that the community needs. So like African-centered school systems, for example, or community health projects. In other words, an economy can do whatever the people in control of it decide it's important for the economy to do. An economy
uh-huh.
can put more money in the workers' pocket, more money in the community, or it can extract that money and take it off to the north side of town. But
right.
if you don't control the business, if we don't control the business, then the people who do will make a decision about where that surplus is going to go, and there's really very little that we can say about it. So
right.
the point of Ujamaa as the economic model is the community owns the businesses. That's the beauty of it. And one way of thinking about that, Sister Q, might be just think about the businesses that you and I have to go in every day to get the goods and services that we need, whether
okay.
it's the AMC theaters that we might go to catch a movie, whether it's the LA Fitness gym that we may use, whether it's the grocery store, whether it's the drugstore. We do not own those businesses for the most part,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's
but
true.
If we pool our dollars and start opening up the very businesses that we need, then not only are our people behind the counter But we also understand that whatever profits that this business generates, we're going to have, it will be us that discern, that make the decision on how that profit is used. That's an extremely empowering position to be in. And most of us have never been there for you know, to any large degree, you know. So, and because we haven't been there, it's really an education process for us to understand that we can do this, that that we have as much right to own and operate businesses as anybody else.
Exactly.
I mean, when we see other groups coming into our community, we should be scratching our heads and saying, wait a minute.
What are
all these foreign folks up in here, you know, running these businesses? You know, we've almost been reduced to the point where if we see one or two black-owned businesses in our area, we say, okay, that's cool.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, if you go to, for example, a Chinatown, in whether you're in Washington, D.C., whether you're in New York, in Brooklyn, or Philly, or any other place that has a large Chinese community, when you go into Chinatown, all of those businesses are operated by Chinese. You can't get up in there without their permission.
I was going to say, not only is that true, but you can get on the road and be like, I don't know, in a desolate place and there's a Chinese restaurant. So
yeah, how about that? And that Chinese restaurant is part of a network of Chinese restaurants.
Absolutely.
Not only do they control the retail outlets, they're also controlling the wholesale operation that provides the cartons
and the
food, the rice production, all of that, that sets up the kitchens, that all of those, I mean, those are vertically operated industries. And that's where we as the folk have to get to. We have to operate the retail aspect, the wholesale aspect, the manufacturing of the equipment that's in the business, all of that should be operated in an Ujamaa fashion. That is, every aspect, every layer of that operation is collectively owned.
Exactly.
And we're guided in terms of how we behave in those businesses as a family. That's what we mean by family-centered. We love one another. We respect one another. We're in there grinding shoulder to shoulder to benefit one another and benefit our community as a collective. That's a whole arena of activity that we have to position ourselves in if we're going to change dynamics of our communities, because Shabaka is absolutely right. In these places where there are high concentrations of our people, they've become murder capital. I mean, and we're in there just shooting each other up left and right. As opposed to, because the other thing is that these institutions, they ground us in reality in a way that we begin to see our own self-worth and our own importance and our own beauty. And without that, all we see is us standing on the corner, either looking for a handout or just spectating, watching other people do business. So us lifting us is the mechanism that allows us to pool our money. That's the key piece. It's the model that Marcus Garvey showed us. We purchase a co-op unit, and with that money that we pool, we then open these cooperative businesses owned and controlled by us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept that will work if we work it. Go ahead, Sister Q.
So I'm hearing you say this, and it sounds very good. As if I'm just, you know, like, out, if I'm just hearing this, I'm trying to get through COVID and I'm trying to get through the day. And why is this important in practical terms? I guess what I'm asking, what difference would this make in any of our lives right now to have this kind of cooperative, you know, business or join forces with a group of people to make this happen? What's
right.
I guess the American way to say it is, what's in it for me?
Right, right.
Because that's how we're taught to think, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And so before we turn that corner, I want to say one other thing. This collective ownership of these businesses, we have to also understand from an economic standpoint that businesses, that factories, that corporations, all of these in an economic sense are what we call means of production.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so every time we open up a business that we own and control, we have launched a vehicle that is part of the means of production. Only people who control means of production make history. Everybody else is a spectator. The people who own, operate, and control the means of production are the ones who are writing history. If you are not owning a business, if you are not operating a business that your group owns and operates, you're a spectator. You're
right.
a second-class citizen, right? So by beginning to operate these businesses, we begin to become the decision makers that determine what our reality will look like. If we don't operate the businesses, then we have to beg the people who do to provide a reality that we think is favorable to us. Do you follow what I'm saying? So one of the primary benefits is, do you want to be a beggar or do you want to be someone that is in control of our own destiny? So the only way we can lift ourselves out of this second-class citizenship is we have to begin to operate and control and own our own businesses at all levels of economic activity. Now, that's still kind of theoretical, so let's just get down to the nitty-gritty of it. We have seen the effects of global warming ravage our community, whether we're talking about New Orleans and Katrina and the storms that have passed through there just recently, whether we're talking about the deep freeze that struck Texas in February that left millions of people in the dark, without heat, without water, in sub-degree temperatures. Now, if you are black or brown folk and you find yourself in that situation, you have to ask yourself the question, whoever is in charge of this don't care nothing about me, and if me and my children are going to survive, we're going to have to get enough power to make sure that this kind of stuff doesn't continue to happen.
Right.
So the most obvious benefit of building a global Ujamaa economy is this. It is the only viable solution to global warming and the impending collapse of our climate. The human family all over the world must shift quickly to renewable energy, but we can't get off fossil fuels because the oil industry is blocking any changes by controlling government, not only in this country, but around the world. So I'm trying to answer your question from a very practical standpoint, because global warming is getting ready to change the reality for millions of black and brown people on the planet, and most certainly here in North America. Yes, we are still in the grip of a global pandemic. And by the way, that pandemic is a reaction to global warming. They don't talk about that, but we'll put that out there and come back to that maybe. And yes, the Republican Party that has become the party of white nationalism is restricting our right to vote at warp speed such that many of us may not be able to vote come 2022 and 2024. Or if we do vote, they'll come in and change they'll take over those election boards and change the results. And so we find ourselves that we have less than 10 years to reduce our carbon emission by 50% or face cataclysmic climate changes that will drive millions of people from their homes, shut down whole economies, disrupt food and water supplies, and put entire coastal areas underwater. These dramatic climate changes are broadcasting hair on fire warning signals even as we're talking tonight. Climate change is not coming next month or next year. It is here right now and will only get worse in the days and weeks and months to come if not rigorously addressed right now. What I'm saying, Sister Q, and what I hope our listeners will hear, is that climate change is an existential threat to the entire human family. Certainly, and black and brown folks are going to get the brunt of it first. And it is an economic challenge that is confronting us. What I mean by that is the fossil fuel industry, big oil, natural gas, big pharma, big agriculture, all of their profit profiles and are based on continuing to burn fossil fuel. So they have no economic incentive to move to renewable sources of energy. They could care less about solar or wind or any other form of energy. They're only, I mean, and it's irrational to the point where they will watch the country burn to the ground, witness the fires on the West Coast, rather than say, hey, we need to change, we need to get off of fossil fuels and move very swiftly to renewable energy. And we've only got 10 years to do this, or we're going to start seeing the worst aspects of this coming at us. Now, because this is an economic issue, this is what I need our listeners to hear. They are able to maintain that insane posture because they are the private owners and controllers of the businesses. Even though millions of people are being adversely affected by this, we have no ability to stop them from doing what they're doing because they own it. You follow what I'm saying?
Got you. I got what you're saying.
And so the only thing we can do is build a countervailing power that can challenge that. And the only way we can build a countervailing policy is to create an economy that is collectively owned by the masses and the majority of the people. That is the only thing that stops these people in their tracks. And so the more that we participate in their systems, I was just at the gas pump today. Gas last week was $2.90. Today is $3.04, right?
Okay.
So every time they need more money, they just go up a penny or two pennies on the price of gas, and they've got billions of dollars additional to work with. And we participate in that system. And then we wring our hands and say, oh, my God, what are we going to do? If we create corporations, if we create these large-scale global cooperatives that are people-owned, because that's the beauty of a cooperative, it's public, it is owned by the people who use the service. So that means for the first, well, not for the first time, but it gives the majority of people the advantage and the opportunity to create our own businesses that we don't have to rely on these bloodsuckers to help us save the planet. And so the challenge that the world is undergoing right now is the question is, which economic model will we follow? Will we continue with this private ownership where these psychopaths and these sociopaths like Trump and the corporations that are funding him if we stay with that, the human family is in deep trouble. We have to say, okay, we understand you guys are psychologically challenged. You have no empathy, no morality. You're just gangsters, you're thugs, and you're not going to do anything different. So what we have to do is take the matters into our own hands and create these cooperative businesses that can provide the services and the goods that we need. In other words, we don't have to rely on Kroger for our food.
Exactly, yes.
You know, I mean, right now, if Kroger shuts down in our communities, most of us are going to be hungry.
Uh-huh.
But there are alternative ways of providing food to feed people. And if have a cooperative, if you organize your own grocery mechanism that you collectively own, you can bring fresh, nutritious produce to your community. We have to take responsibility for our own survival. And we do it through the creation of these family-centered, group-owned, collectively-owned, economic cooperative businesses. That is why it is imperative that we begin to pool our money today, because we don't have to wait for anyone to do this. That's the beauty, that's the genius of the cooperative process. We don't have to wait for anybody. All we have to do is get together in our neighborhoods and say, hey, there's another way to organize our community. There's another way to provide goods and services that benefit us and that meet our needs. And at the same time, the wealth that these businesses produce, we then can use that same wealth to educate our children, to provide health care for our friends and our neighbors and our families. We can provide for ourselves everything we need via a cooperative business model. So this is not optional, Sister Q, at this point. What's in it for me? Survival. If we allow ourselves to remain dependent on these extractive businesses, that as soon as they don't make enough money, they shutter their doors and move their businesses, then we're going to continue to live in these places that are run down, abandoned stores, abandoned businesses, out of control police. And our children are going to be at risk.
Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of that, go ahead.
No, I was thinking that, there's like what they call a prepper community, and it's always like one person or one family trying to be prepared for whatever comes along.
Right.
And
right.
What you're suggesting is a community that is immune from whatever comes along. Because if we're running our own businesses and doing everything in the way that we wanted to, what happens outside of that has nothing to do really with us, you know? We can
just
keep doing what we do.
Right. And there's a couple of practical benefits. A, only organized communities survive calamity best. So whatever comes down the pipe, if your community is organized, you have a much higher chance of survival. That's number one.
Doubt.
Number two, individuals cannot go up against institutions. You know, just throw that out of your mind. We are not going to take on Exxon Shell as individuals. Not going to happen. The power of institutions overwhelm individuals 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. So throw that out of our mind. Therefore, we have to organize. We have to connect with one another. We have to build the linkages. And we do that by building cooperative businesses. That puts us in conversation with each other. And the beauty of the cooperative is as it becomes stronger and stronger, it's democratic because the decision-making is done by the members. No one external or beyond it is telling people what to do.
Right.
It really is from a historical standpoint, what we are witnessing, what we are living through, is the shift, the global shift, from private ownership of the means of production and wealth to public ownership of the means and production and wealth. So we think that we've been called by the ancestors and positioned to give leadership in this critical hour by guiding people. How do you put together a family-centered cooperative? What is it that holds this group of people together? What is it that helps them to grow in a spirit of love and self-support such that they are able to meet their needs? That's what the world is searching for. People who are clear enough and strong enough to recognize that the system that we're in is collapsing. It's dying. Mm-hmm. And we have the opportunity to build the alternative that will give us a real shot at living much healthier and more productive lives. So we're honored in Us Lifting Us to be part of that global transformation. But it starts at a very basic level. Looking at our communities, what businesses can we operate, pulling together, putting up our dollar, purchasing our co-op unit for $1,000, and we take that money, and then we open business after business after business. And so no matter what happens, we're much better positioned to withstand it, to overcome it, and to show the world a better way to live going forward.
Absolutely. Okay. Wow. Brother Auntie, it's after 10 o'clock.
I see that.
Well, since we already are at 10 o'clock, Brother Unki, how do people join Ulu? Come to
the village website, usliftingus.com, USLIFTINGUS.com, and check us out, see what we're saying. If it makes sense, you'll see a tab that says join. Click on that, and that will start the process. You'll give us some information. We'll give you some information, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you,
Brother Unki. That's the easiest way to do this, Sister Q. Thank you. Enjoy talking with you tonight.
I enjoyed your conversation, and we have to keep drilling, I want to say drilling, but I don't really think that's what I want to say. But we have to keep making the point of the value of, just not even against anything, just for ourselves. So
thank you so much for saying it that way.
Yes. I thank you, Brother Unki, for sharing with us tonight. And we want to thank everyone of the listeners for joining us this evening. Join us again next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock Eastern Time for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.
Peace, sister. Stay strong.
You too, brother. Peace.
Will do. Thank you.